Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. This is Manmeet Singh. Today is June 15, 2023. I am interviewing for the first time, Keen. This interview is taking place at New York in Ithaca in the home slash office of my temporary residence in Ithaca, California, New York. This interview is sponsored by Jakarta and is a part of the Storytelling and Settlement Through Sikh LGBTQIA Plus Oral Histories Project. The purpose of this research is to document the lived experiences of Sikhs in the United States who are from the LGBTQIA Plus backgrounds. We want to provide a more complete history of Sikhs through interviews that ask LGBTQIA plus Sikhs about their different experiences, how LGBTQIA plus Sikhs understand themselves and their communities, and how LGBTQIA plus Sikhs make home in the US. So thank you so much again for being willing to sit down with me and share your story. So we are going to get started with a bit more broad with our conversation. So when you think about your experience of growing up, tell me a little bit about what comes up for you. To you, like, are there any common stories, any smells, any relationships that come to mind that help you describe growing up? And I'll also drop the question into the chat as well.
Thank you for having me here today. I'm really excited to be a part of this project in any capacity. The question here, let me look it up again. Actually, the first thing that comes to mind with that question is the volume of my parents speaking on the phone whenever they would call family back in India. So my parents immigrated here in the 80s, like right after they got married, and my dad was continuing his education in the States. And it was definitely part of the brain drain from Asia in the 80s to the US at that time, because my dad was college educated and my mom actually fought to get probably what is the equivalent of an associate's degree in art before she got married. And she was the eldest in her family, so that was quite controversial for her, for the culture. But my dad's family eventually moved out here, but my mom's family stayed in Delhi. And so hearing them on the phone growing up, because you would only be able to talk for maybe 3 minutes, and the connection was always so bad. And so they talked so loudly to each other on the phone, and that I could hear my masis, like, and my nanny, like, calling back to my mom while she's just trying to get some type of connection, some type of remnants of home that she had left when married, as the traditions were back then. But yeah, that one is really distinct. I remember also there was a Indian store that was like India Sweets and Spices. It was down the street from my parents' house. And always going there to pick up the bootleg Bollywood films that had been released. And like my mom pulling up and being like, just go drop off the video and come back and tell them it's from us. And being so nervous and running into the store. And of course it had all these different smells that I was so familiar with, but I couldn't name. But it smelled like the kitchen at home and those things. And dropping off the video and always being like, can we get mangoes? Always asking for mangoes while getting back in the car. Those are some distinct ones. Going to the Gurdwara also. I loved prasad. I loved prasad growing up. I mean, my child doesn't, but always just I used to do this thing with my sibling where I'd be like, I can do it in one bite. And so I would like, I would do the prayer to my head and everything. And then I'd like the whole thing, because you'd only get one napkin. And it was like, I can't keep making a mess. So I just like eat the whole prasad in one bite and then wipe my face. You know, going to the Gurdwara for me growing up, my parents never really had us learn the language. So for me, I can understand Punjabi and Hindi to like a certain extent, but I can't distinguish the languages. But like whenever I visit India, I can get by in conversation, but not speaking. I can understand and then I respond in English. Also, I get teased if I try to speak the language, so it kind of deters me. Yeah, I remember like being in the Gurdwara, and because I couldn't necessarily understand what was being said, I would get distracted pretty easily. And a way to kind of navigate my behavior so I wasn't distracting others, I would go to the kitchen. So I was always surrounded by aunties and the bhais that were there that were like working in the kitchen and making the rotis and the puris, and like seeing these incredible women like throwing puris on the fire and just like sticking their hands in the fire and like flipping them and thinking like that was the coolest thing. And so I would help make get the atta and like try and roll the rotis. So for me, like the Gurdwara was often just like food oriented because I was in the kitchen helping make langar and serving langar. So that was enough for me and my parents to kind of be in Sikhi while growing up, even if I didn't necessarily understand what was being said. I was still being of service and practicing seva and like doing things that I think fall under the major tenets of Sikhism as I relate to it. But I mean, those are memories that I honestly think I forgot about until you asked this question. The relationship that probably sticks out in my mind the most is that of mine with my Masi. My mom has two sisters, but my mom has one sister that's like only 18 months younger than her. So she was very close in age. But with her, I always felt like this unbreakable bond. Like I've always felt so connected to her. And so she was in India and I was here, and I always missed her so much, and I'd always cry so much. And like I understand it, like being the child in that dynamic. But now that my sister has children, and now my sister's oldest daughter is 5 years old and she calls me Masi. She actually calls me Fasi Masi because when she was younger, she couldn't say M's. So she put an F there, which is just like that word. It's in America, it's not a big deal, but in India, like that would be so funny to say, but she calls me that. But the way she like cries now whenever I leave, because I live far away from my family, 7 hours, but I live far enough away that I don't get to see my nieces all the time. I see like life continuing, and now I'm the Masi, and it's just like I want to be in their heads like the way that my Masi is in mine. Like I want to be with their hearts the way my Masi is with me. So I think of all the relationships that I had, it was with her. And I actually just went to India and I visited my mom's side just this past December, and my Masi was like, do you remember that paper you wrote about me? And I was like, no. She pulls out this paper from 2002 that I wrote about, apparently like I was assigned an essay for like to write an essay about like an inspirational woman in my life. And I actually had written it about my Masi. And so like I sat there and I like read it to her and I was reading it and I just started crying because I was, that part of my life is such a blur. And so to know that, oh, that this feeling that I have now that is tethered to my Masi, it's been there. Like that's been a constant in my life. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like these are a bit more of the positive feelings, the ones that like make my heart swell and tether me to others before I was ever tethered to myself or really understanding myself. But yeah, growing up specifically, those are some of the things that I remember the most. And a silly story. I remember going to a school in kindergarten in California, and there's like, in when you're like really young, that's when you're learning the basics of everything. So you're learning like words and connections and middle names and all these different things. And I remember like asking my friends, I was like, oh, so like, what are your middle names? And I was blown away when I found out that like people had different like middle names or like last names than their siblings. And I was like, you don't mean that all of the sisters have Kaur and Singh? Like it wasn't like I was blown away by that. Like I didn't understand that like in different cultures. And that was probably one of the first times that I was like, oh, I'm different. Because in my household, all of the people who are deemed women have Kaur as their middle or last name, and all the people deemed men have Singh. So that was like one of the first moments where I was like, oh, like I am different. And then of course with the holidays, as you grow up and realizing that all the holidays that you celebrate with your family, you don't get off from school, unlike the other kids who get all their holidays with their family while they're off school. And you know, like my parents always taught me that like that difference was special. It was unique. And that, you know, while you might feel left out from what your like friends are having with their families, you remember that like you always have us. Like you always have us as a family, you have us as a community. And they always wanted to emphasize that like all these get-togethers that we did with other Punjabi people and other South Asian and Middle Eastern people, like, this is also your community. Like, you're a part of it growing up. And you have to come. You have to. You can't opt out. You have to come. Oh my God, so many get-togethers growing up that I never wanted to go to. Because I wanted to go, but, like, it was always so stressful getting ready for them, and honestly, like traumatic to a certain degree, like getting ready for certain South Asian parties, just because like my mom's sense of urgency is one that I now inhabit, absolutely. I now understand it and things like that. But growing up, her sense of urgency for getting ready for parties and presenting a certain way, because what will the others say, you know, if you show up not looking put together, you know, that stress, it, to this day, like my heart will increase knowing that we have to get ready for something, or that we have to host a party, or that something. But I mean, it was always great, like meeting other people my age who were like me, that, you know, we could dance and eat and I don't have to come up with the English word for everything to define what I'm doing. That was worthwhile. Yeah. And then of course and as far as like smells, the Indian sweets and spices stores, like the mango, smelling the mango skin, all the spices that now I understand is jeera and elaichi and adrak and all these delicious things with, especially with cha, like just like the other, adding adrak to cha, I like game changer. Just everything in the world. Oh my God. I actually just recently like learned how to make it the way my Masi makes it. So I've been just relishing in it and having cha all the time. And I'm like out of the bowl, like just like as like real as possible. But that one's a big one. And and then actually I discovered at a young age that I'm allergic to agarbatti. So whenever I would be in temple or my cousins are half Jain. And so sometimes I would go to mandir with them, and like get exposed to like Hindu experiences and Gujarati food and all of those type of things. And they use agarbatti a lot for their prayers. And I'd always be like, I can't sit through this because I would feel sick. Like I would get a migraine or I would get like the kid equivalent of that. And as I got older, it developed into just migraines. And it's now been understood that I have an allergy to it, which of all the things for me to be allergic to, agarbatti, like, dang, it's the American in me. You know what I'm saying? but my parents are super respectful about it. And so when it comes to prayers, they try not to use agarbatti. Or if they do, they let me excuse myself and those type of things. So agarbatti is a big smell that reminds me of my upbringing. Yeah, those are just some. I don't know. I also have like horrible things that I could, like pan. So pan is also one. That's a definite distinct smell. All the uncles going out during parties and finding the uncles smoking and chewing on pan and spitting and like all that stuff. And them just smelling like scotch. Oh my God. When I grew up and learned what those smells were, like when I was a kid, they were comforting. It was interesting because some of my like my chacha and stuff like always like had that smell on him, especially at parties. And I'd be like just hanging out and like not realizing what's happening. And then I grew up and I started working in restaurants and bars and stuff. And then I was like, that smell is scotch. That smell is leftover cigarette on someone's jacket. Like, and then pan is a little bit more obscure. So I remember, oh my God, that was such a distinct scent growing up. And now I'm like just thinking about it, it's almost comical how much these things inform my childhood and my existence. And then my birthday party is in the summer, so I always had like a backyard barbecue type birthday. So the smell of barbecue is also pretty like distinct with my upbringing. And you know, my cousins who are half Punjabi, half Gujarati, they are completely vegetarian. And so I was very familiar with vegetarianism growing up. Like that wasn't foreign to me. When I went to school and I like would talk about it, people were like, they almost like used vegetarian as like an otherness. And I was just like, what? Like, I didn't understand it. It was just something that was real in my life. But my family, like there weren't dietary restrictions. Like we would eat burgers and we would eat chicken, fish, like lamb, anything. So like, yeah, barbecue burgers were like my birthday, like I would associate growing up with my birthday, which is arguably very American for me and like in California and stuff like that. And it's funny because now I don't eat meat because I actually get sick when I eat it, but I'll eat fish, but all other meats, like they don't tempt me anymore. But growing up now and understanding how diet has been used as like almost like punitively against people of certain castes, I'm like, oh, it makes sense why even we were judged for eating beef. Even though we come from my family are caste privileged, we would get judged for eating beef and the vegetarianism practiced by Gujarati Jains like was the norm for them because of the way that diets are used as like a you're immoral thing for people of certain castes. So my understanding of that has really evolved. Wow, that was a really long answer to your question.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for sharing like such a rich and a beautiful response to. And I guess I kind of thinking also maybe about gender and sexuality. How did you learn more about these topics?
You know, I think I have been informed passively about gender and sexuality since before I was born. Interestingly enough, when the doctors read my mom's ultrasound when she was pregnant with me, the doctors said that I was going to come out as a male. They read me as a male. And then when I came out and it wasn't it's a boy or whatever, they designated me as it's a girl. I think just from that beginning, I'm like, how did they know? But my mom always called me her helper. Like I was her best helper. And from a very young age, it was always, everything was separated by gender. All the men were on one side and all the women were on one side. Even at the Gurdwara, all the men are on one side and all the women are on one side. And that was like probably one of the first times that I like noticed it. And I was always kind of curious about it. And I remember when I was maybe like 10 years old, I told my parents, I was like, I'm not going to get arranged married. Like I told them this, and I'm the youngest, and I told them this, and they were just like, well, what are we going to do with you kind of thing? Like, what are we going to do? And I was like, now looking back, I was probably like, y'all came to America. Like I get this choice. You know what I'm saying? Like I see it that way. But yeah, I was like, I'm not going to get arranged married. I never like growing up, I never saw myself getting married. I never had stereotypical feminine expression, or what people assume people who are socialized to be girls and women are supposed to have, except I was still socialized in that way. So I have a very loud voice, and I'm very outspoken and I'm very opinionated. And my parents got me involved in politics at a very young age. They helped challenge me. They were like, what do you think of these things in the world? Like, you know, and it was always from the perspective of Seva, from like, look at how much we have and look at how little others have. We need to make sure to help those who don't have the means to help themselves. And that's a tenet that I still value very much in me today. But it was always like my mom and my bua and my aunties and everybody, they were always making the food, running the parties. They were the ones watching the kids. They were the one doing all the emotional labor. And my dad was working so hard every single day at his business. Like he was gone all day, every day. When I was younger than five, my dad, he worked out of state. So he would be gone from Monday to Saturday. And then he'd come home Saturday night, spend Sunday with us, and then fly back on Monday and go to work. And he was trying to figure out if he wanted to fly us all out to Texas to where he was finding work, until he eventually decided to start his own business in California. So we stayed in California. But I definitely like, because I'm the youngest, I grew up with my parents being the wealthiest that they were. So I didn't really have to see the living in one apartment. I didn't see the, but I did always have hand-me-downs, you know, those type of things. But as far as like gender and sexuality, like my brother and I were raised by different parents. Like we just were, he's the eldest. And just seeing him and understanding him and the way he's able to get away with so much that I would never be able to get away with, quote unquote, get away with. My parents did something with me and my siblings. I'm the youngest of three, where my parents were like, you've seen your siblings mess up in these ways, so you should already know better. So I was held to the standard of you'll be punished more because you knew better kind of thing. Which I feel like is kind of like a reverse, like that's usually what happens with the eldest kid, like that they get the harshest punishments and things like that. And I remember, God, there's so much with gender and being Punjabi and the ways that they expect women to act and men to act. Like, I was always a tomboy. That's what they called me. You know that term, a tomboy? It's like a girl who acts like a boy, essentially. Because I was in all the sports. I always wanted to play every kind of sport. I was always like the first to volunteer. I was always the one asking questions and participating, and I was uninhibited. And then as I went to school and I was told, be less, be quieter. You need to mind yourself. You're going to get in trouble. You're in trouble. Go to detention. All these different things. And then, you know, it was reinforced. It was at home, and then it was reinforced at school as well, like to make myself smaller. Don't make others, like, you're talking over other people. Like, and now I'm like, okay, I want to balance making space for others and making sure everybody's voices are heard and things like that. But before it was just like, be quiet, be mindful, like in ways that definitely affected me. And you know, the way my grandparents, my dadi dada, the way they treated the grandsons as opposed to the granddaughters. Now, the way that I'm speaking of this is from the perspective of being socialized as a woman, being raised as a woman. You know, I am non-binary, I'm trans, I use they, them pronouns. I understand myself to be gender expansive. I don't believe myself to be limited by the institution of gender, except for when the institution of gender forces me to act in a limited way, like choosing bathrooms or the hundreds and millions of other ways that, you know, getting paid less. Try to push me into a less challenging role, like different things that tend to be about like attributed to women in the workforce. So yeah, when I'm speaking of these experiences, it's from the perspective of being a girl, like being socialized in that way. And I'm still seen that way in my family, even though I have communicated with my mom that I use they, them pronouns. And it's funny because I have friends that use they, them pronouns, and my mom uses they, them pronouns for them. But she somehow with me, it just slips her mind. She's like, you're my youngest daughter. You are a powerful woman, like all these things. And I'm like, just switch it to person. I'm going to feel so much better if you just say person. Like, but we'll get there. I tend to not hold people whose first language isn't English to the same standard. Like my parents, I think English was not my parents' first language. My parents speak like four or five languages each, and English is one of them, but it's not their first. So I don't hold them to certain pronouns things. And also I don't feel like pronouns define my gender. I feel like pronouns actually speak to how others view me. It's not how I view me. It just speaks to your perspective. And your perspective, albeit can be important, it does not nearly matter as much as how I see myself and how I feel. And so if you don't use they, them pronouns, like, I mean, that's more on you than it is on me. Like, I know who I am, but it can be quite activating whenever I go home. And but my cousins are so good about it, and my sister is really good about it, and they're very adamant about it. And my nieces, they have no idea what I am. Like, they call me Masi. The 5-year-old can talk. The 1-year-old is still like figuring out words. She can't like speak in sentences and stuff, but the 5-year-old can form sentences and have thoughts now and remember things and stuff like that. And she switches pronouns with me all the time. And it brings me so much joy because I'm just happy that she's just flowing with it. She will use he, she'll use she, she'll use they, she'll just use all these different pronouns with me. And then whenever we play house, which is her favorite thing to play, I'm always something. I'm always like, can you be the auntie? Can you be the uncle? Can you be the daddy? Can you be the brother? Can you be the this? Can you be my friend? And it's people of all genders. And she also refers to my partner as my wife. And like, so she's learning that, you know, things are different. And, you know, one time she saw me in a bra and she was like, you know, my daddy doesn't wear a bra. And I was like, I looked at her and I was like, you know, Ava, like some daddies do wear bras. And she's like, okay. And then she just walked away. She doesn't care. Like, she's just like learning. And that is very affirming for me. Like, her asking me a ton of questions and trying to figure what I am out. And she, like, I showed her a picture of me with long hair and she's like, I don't remember you looking like that. And I was like, yeah, baby, it was from before you were born. Like, I had really long hair. But that's really affirming for me, right? And it's really like, I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to also be a child, like heal my inner child through being with my nieces. But you know, I also recognize that sometimes like my parents will listen to me before they listen to my sister. And I recognize that as like the Punjabi like power dynamic where like men's or masculine voices tend to be listened to. Like they will heed what I say before they will heed what my sister says. And even though she's older than me, she is a cis woman. And so as I've transitioned, like internally and externally, like socially as well, I try and make it so that when I'm in a space where my sister is speaking up and speaking out, I'm amplifying her voice. Because I understand that in that power dynamic, even though that I've been there and I understand what it's like to be silenced as a woman. And I want to make sure that she's listened to, you know, and she's been ignored a lot or gaslit a lot about her feelings her whole life. And so I always am like, hey, they're valid. I'm here. I'm holding space for you, that kind of thing. And she does the same for me. So, you know, that's a way that I recognize how gender dynamics play out in my family. Whereas when it's my brother, I have very little patience with the way he thinks things should be and the way he kind of like carries himself. And I have a lot of trauma from my brother growing up, and it carries out to this day. And it's really hard because he now currently like really needs help, especially with substance use. And I know that alcohol use disorder is like really rampant in the Punjabi community. And you know, my chacha, my brother, it's not something I'd wish on anybody. And I recognize my brother needing help, and I see him as a man who needs help. And because of all, like, it's a multiple truths thing. It's like, I'm a person who, if it was like one of my friends who was going through something like this, I would be pulling out every stop. I would be like, here's this resource. Let me know what you need. I'll bring you food. I'll help you clean your place. I'll help you do all these different things. But when it's with someone who has like hurt me so deeply and messed with my neural pathways so much, I'm finding myself a bit reserved. So I'm learning about my own boundaries with it. And I'm still reaching out and checking in with him and being like, hey, I'm really grateful that you're finally ready to get some help. This is what I'm able to do. I can check in with you once a week, kind of thing. And now that we're adults, it's very, very different. I also left home at 17 because I knew I was different from everyone else. And I never felt seen for some reason. And I could never put words to the feelings. And then, you know, when I left home at 17 for school and I didn't go back, I learned a lot about myself. And that was where I was able to explore my sexuality and then eventually my gender. And, you know, one of the things about my gender is that I didn't realize that when I had left home, the way I was living my lifestyle, I don't know, me living authentically every day in and out, because it was just me with my chosen family. I didn't realize that I was challenging gender expectations. When I went back home at the age of 27, when my sister was getting married, when it's shadi ka ghar, you have to pull out all the stops. You were the family hosting the wedding, and my sister married someone who isn't Indian. So we really had to do the entire like labor of the wedding and all the things that were expected of me as a daughter of the house that was hosting the wedding. I realized, I was like, this is not me. Like, y'all got me fucked up. Like, this is not me. Like, this doesn't feel right. Like, nothing, I'm feeling challenged in ways that are making me very, very uncomfortable. And it wasn't until after that that I was like, I don't think that I am just one thing. I think I am multiple things. And sometimes I think I'm nothing at all, like when it comes to gender. And that's when I started, like, I guess kind of labeling it a bit more. And like realizing that, oh, I do identify with like how non-binary people describe how they feel every day and how trans people talk about themselves and their gender and like fluidity and all this type of things. I'm like, why can't that also be real? And it really started me on this journey of self-discovery, of community, of softness for others, acceptance, because I have to accept me, especially because I have to make this path for myself. There are ancestors. There absolutely are ancestors. I know I have queer ancestors. I know I do. It's just, and I know I have queer family members, but none of them will be socially queer. None of them will end up like letting themselves love someone of a different gender than cis normativity, a cis heteronormativity. But they tell me that I definitely have cousins who are like, oh, I did this, or I'm attracted to this person, or I flirted with this person, or this is happening. And I'm feeling like wearing clothes like this. And I want to, you know, wear a wig and makeup and all this. And I'm just like, yeah, fucking do it. Like, please, I'm the rainbow sheep. Like, I'm all alone out here. Like, someone in the family, don't make me the angry queer at every family location that's bringing up like left leaning things about how like power and like power to the people and all this stuff. And I'm constantly aware of how alone I am when it comes to being with the family I was born into. I'm constantly aware of it. And you know, there are some moments of joy where things are welcome. Like, my mom wished me happy pride this year, which she's never done before. And my family's so welcoming of my partner, which I never, ever thought would happen. And you know, there is a lot of beauty, but it's very, very lonely. And I just hope that by being me, that like all my nibblings, like they know they can come to me. And I think they know that I'm different. And so if they're ever feeling different, I never want them to feel as alone as I have felt since I became self-aware at the age of like 9. I grew up very fast. There's a lot of trauma in my household. I grew up very, very quickly. I hope they never feel alone, how I felt growing up and how I feel now at times. I feel less alone now because I'm able to build community and be with others in certain ways. But, you know, as a kid, it's really hard to find that. Or it was. I don't know what technology now. But, yeah, and... You know, okay, so I'll share something that's a bit like triggering or activating. So please let me know if a pause is needed. But, you know, I grew up knowing that India was not a safe place for women. That was one thing that I don't remember when I became fully aware of that. But modesty was always pushed on me growing up. And when I was like 11 years old and I went to India, no, I was 12, I think. Summer vacation in California is monsoon season in India. So when you go to India during the June to August months, you know, it's monsoon season, so it's raining all the time. And that was when I learned that I'm supposed to be wearing bras, even though I hadn't developed breasts in any way. I hadn't started my period. I was still very much an adult, like a prepubescent. I was still a child. Like I hadn't started puberty. And that's when I learned like, oh, I need to wear bras and I need to cover up. And it's 113 degrees and humid out there. And I was still in a child mindset to a certain degree. So I was wearing shorts and tank tops. I didn't care that my clothes were see-through. But I got punished very badly when I was in India and wearing shorts in 115 degree weather. And I was like, this is some bullshit. I mean, I'm saying that now. As a kid, I wasn't allowed to swear, so I didn't. But there was this... There was this moment when I went out with my cousin brothers out there and we were buying fireworks because we were going to set off some fireworks because the Independence Day was coming up. And it was just me and my cousins. And it was like the first time my mom let me out like alone in India. And I wasn't even alone. I was with my cousin brothers who were older than me by like 5 years. And one of them only 1 year. And it was me and my sister and my cousin brothers. And there was this moment where it was really, really crowded. And while I was in the crowd, my sister and I were grabbed at and our body parts and we were violated. We were molested like in this crowd and people were trying to grab us and pull us away. And, you know, now when I look back on it, I'm like, was I going to be kidnapped, you know, like thinking about it, because it was this very public place and we were these young children. My sister is 3 years older than me. So I was 12, she was 15. So she was a bit more, I guess, like physically developed than me, but the way she was getting grabbed and the way that I was getting grabbed, it stays with me to this day. And I've done like a lot of trauma therapy now as an adult about it, but I have a lot of anxiety in crowds now. But like when my brothers, like cousin brothers, like realized what was happening, they like picked me and my sister up and like just shoved through the crowd and got us out of there. So they protected us. And I'm eternally grateful to them for that, because they were also children. Like they were adolescents, they were teenagers. They didn't know and they didn't have sisters. So they like to this day, like they feel so much anger about that time because they feel anger at the world and they feel anger at like themselves because they're like, I hate that that's how I learned that the world is different for you. You know, because they had the privilege of not having to worry about those kind of things, you know? And so it was in that moment, which I didn't really remember until years later, that I was like, something's different. Something's off. Something's different about me. This doesn't feel right. Like, there are things that are not making sense to me. Why is the world different for me as a girl than they are for the boys? Like, what is happening? You know, it's all these like horrible questions. And, you know, like, as I've grown up, I'm just like, and that has challenged my notions or like my comfort with my sexuality and my gender and things like that, and also wanting to make the world a safer place for women, you know, and kids and things like that. But I think it is prudent to bring up as a part of my upbringing, because it is not uncommon for South Asian femmes in India or feminine presenting people to experience things like sexual assault or molestation and things like that. And that has informed my story, that has informed my life. And, you know, as an adult now, like, I only read about what happens in India now, you know, and you can't separate caste dynamics from sexual assault in India because of the way that Dalit women are treated out there. Dalit femmes are treated out there, and they are sexually assaulted every single day in India. And their molesters, the people who are enacting these crimes on them, these horrific behaviors on them, these power dynamics, are from privileged castes, and they don't get punished for it. They've learned that they can get away with it, and it's not just a man woman thing. It's a caste dynamic thing at play as well. So it's like, you can't separate gender and caste. And even though I come from caste privilege and I experienced like sexual assault, sexual molestation at a young age in India growing up, I hold so much space and empathy for Dalit femmes, for any femmes in India, because of what they've experienced. And, you know, I have cousins out there who have never experienced anything like that, you know, but I it's just, it's not unfamiliar. And it's a part of a lot of our stories. And I mean, for anybody who's listening to this, I hope you know that I see you, and I hope you know your worth and your value, and that you can love yourself more than you can hate them. And that you focus on building relationships with yourself and people that you love and feel safe with. And that you feel brave in this world that tried to take something from you, because I struggle with that message every day. You know, I struggle with the message all the time, but I have to remind myself that things are different for me now. Like, and that, yeah, loving yourself matters more than hating them, as that goes. But there's been a lot that's informed my sexuality and gender, and like, also, never seeing any queer person in my life when I was growing up that was South Asian, that was always really rough. It's hard to believe that you're real if you don't see it in others too, I guess. But like, getting to a point where accepting that queer South Asians, queer trans South Asians, like, exist because I exist, like, that, it's been a journey, and it's rough, but to be in community with others and to be like, I see you and you see me. And I don't know, it's really powerful. I know I'm kind of going all over the place in regards to this, but I'm okay. I'm feeling okay. It's just sharing something so intimate and personal. I just want like people listening to know that they're not alone, I guess, and that I see them. I see them, even if others don't. And I hope that when they look in the mirror, that they see love. You know, at least a little bit. At least they can note some love and joy and understand that pain can be transmuted. And that I'm sorry if you ever felt less than, because I know that feeling, and it's not very nice. It's not something I wish on people. And that, yeah, that's a, yeah. Why? Did you mute yourself?
Now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Okay.
I think maybe my headphones are no longer. But I was just saying thank you so much for your vulnerability and for sharing that, and for all your generosity too, and like trusting and like gifting your part of the story, like in hopes that it, like, for other folks too, like thank you for that. And I guess, like, and in terms of, as we were just talking about gender and sexuality, kind of going off of that, thinking about how you understand your gender and sexuality today, if you had to define some of your life so far in terms of phases, what would they be? Like, so phases or like chapters? I can drop this in the chat as well.
Oh my goodness, phases and chapters. How many genders have I been through? So many. That's like a funny question, because I was just visiting home and I saw pictures of me from like prom in high school, and I'm like, who is this person? But so there was, you know, it's funny. Oh my God, okay, I'm thinking about all of this. My first kiss was actually with a girl. When I like look back at my life, my first kiss was with a girl, and it was with, I don't know what it was. Okay. So I was in elementary school, and, I kind of like tutored my classmates, or my teachers always had to keep me busy, essentially. I always finished my work very quickly, and then I would be distracting to other students. And so they kind of tasked me with, hey, when you finish your work, walk around and ask if anybody else needs help. And I remember I have this friend, and I will spare sharing her name, but she she's Muslim, and she and I were friends outside of class, but she didn't need help, but I was like, oh, let's talk, and I can pretend like I'm helping you, right? So we were just like hanging out and blah, blah, and we were just like talking, and I just leaned forward and kissed her. Like it was almost like a reflex, and like, I remember her just pulling back and her eyes being so big, and almost like, in the way I interpreted it, it was like mortified. And then I was mortified. And then I just ran away, and we never talked about it again. And so that, like, thinking back on that, I was 8 years old. Like there was nothing. She was so young. She wasn't even wearing hijab yet. Like it was just this like moment of like, and I did it. I don't know why. And if you know me now, I am so the person who like asked for consent before kissing and all this. But me as a kid, I was like, I kissed this girl. I don't know. It's just so funny. But I was just like, yeah, I grew up as a little girl that had masculine tendencies. Like I played all the sports. I played with boys. I had a lot of guy friends. So that was definitely like a chapter of my life, like with childhood, like always masculine things that I would do. And I'd always wear like shorts. Sometimes I'd walk around without a shirt on. And then I got punished for that pretty severely. By the time I reached kindergarten, if I was still walking around without a shirt on, I would get punished pretty badly. So I learned very quickly, I'm not allowed to have my chest out. I'm not allowed to be topless. And so that definitely informed gender. Kissing that girl when I was 8 years old and four, I'm sure informs my sexuality now. Or it's just like a funny little anecdote because kids are just curious and they're exploring. I don't want them to be punished. It's so funny to think of now. I remember when I went to India when I was 7. I wanted to get my hair cut really short, like really, really short, because honestly, like the look kind of, but it was more the it was just so hot. So I wanted short hair because I was so hot, and my mom wouldn't let me. But eventually they let me. But with the humidity, my hair like poofed. It like went completely up, and my parents didn't know about hair product. I didn't know about hair product, so they just let it be. So I had this like really poofy short hair. And because I was always playing with the guys, I had kids in India, my cousins, friends and stuff. They always asked me if I was a girl or a boy when I was a kid. And I remember being like offended. And I was like, I'm a girl. What are you talking about? Of course I'm a girl. All these things. So even at a young age, I knew that there was shame associated with presenting as a gender that was different than your sex assigned at birth, than the gender that was assigned to you at birth. So I knew, and I still had that shame. And I mean, to this day, I'm still not a man. You can't be calling me that, like as it goes, because being a man, how embarrassing. No, I'm just kidding. So there was those phases. So it was just kind of like a lot of confusion, but I knew what I liked, and I really saw myself in my cousin Tiffany, because my cousin Tiffany, she was my Chacha's second daughter, and to this day, I still feel so at home with her. So along with like the family relationships that we talked about at the beginning, Tiffany is definitely one of them. My cousin, she lived with me here in the States. Her dad, my Chacha, actually married a Christian woman, a white Christian woman from the States. So she's mixed. So, looking back on it, on my dad's side of the family, my parents are the only ones who were same race, religion, and caste, and cisgender heteronormative relationship. My bua married someone Jain. My Chacha married someone Christian. And white, so a different race altogether. So yeah, I kind of grew up knowing that difference, like atypicalness, wasn't necessarily super stigmatized, but there was no same sex. There was no queer representation in the dynamics. But my cousin Tiffany, she played the sports that I played, and she was so good. I like idolized her, and she was so powerful, and she was participating in all these masculine things, but she was still dating guys, and she was still like able to like put makeup on. And sometimes she wouldn't put makeup, actually more often than not, she didn't put makeup on, but she was this like masculine, quote unquote, masculine behaviored woman who was dating men. And she pulled, like she pulled, I'm not gonna lie. And I just like idolized her because she was also like excellent at sports and stuff like that. And she was just like the kindest person. So I was like, oh, maybe I'm just like that, And then so that was like as I was going into like middle school and things like that. And then, traumatic things happened in India, and I learned a bit more about gender disparities and how people are treated based on gender, how they have to function in this world based on their gender presentations being received. And then I got to high school, and I was just so depressed. High school was probably one of the worst times of my life. So as far as a phase goes with gender and sexuality, looking back on my friend group at that time, very queer, very queer coded. I have, yeah, they, most of them. And they would tease me about being bisexual, and I'd be like so defensive. I'd be like, I'm not bisexual. Like, why would you say this? Blah, blah, blah. I was also like not really dating people or like crushing on people or interested in people. And there was this, and I was on the soccer team, so I was also around all these like masculine women, but then a lot of them had boyfriends. Like, it's very confusing. Now that I'm still following some of them on social media, now some of them have come out as queer, and I'm like, this makes sense. But, you know, we weren't like that in high school. I was part of GSA, the Gender Sexuality Ally, like, class. It was Gay Straight Alliance. So I was straight. I was part of that in high school. Like, all these things that when you look back, I'm like, oh my God. My cousins tease me because I wore a headband like every day in middle school. So they're like, you know, Keen, we knew. And I was like, you could have told me. Would have saved me a lot of time, a lot of like stress in my brain. Yeah. And like, I know I'm like older than you, but when I was in high school, that's when Facebook started. And that's when social media really started and the internet, like connecting with strangers online, became a thing. And that's when I sort of started exploring my sexuality more. And I specifically only did like straight, like I only talked to men or people who identified as men. And it was a lot of like hypersexual behavior online to kind of navigate feelings that I was having in my body that scared me. Because my parents never talked to me about sex. They never taught me about what was normal or to be expected in my body. Like, I didn't start puberty until I was a freshman in high school, which is a bit late for some people. I was definitely I didn't start my period until after all my friends had started their periods. High school was like really confusing for me because I didn't have words for how I was feeling and how I was identifying. And I didn't have anyone around me who was sharing things with me or their curiosities with me. And I was also dealing with a lot of violence at home, between like my family members. And it was a very like, I felt very isolated at that time. And I also actually physically injured my body in high school. So I wasn't able to play soccer. So I didn't have an outlet anymore. And I wasn't allowed to exercise because my body was hurt. And I got into a really bad car accident where a drunk driver hit me and like all these things that affected my body. And then all of a sudden I couldn't play sports. So I had all this energy because I had been an athlete my whole life. I was someone who exercised like 6 to 7 times a week, playing multiple sports, like usually soccer or swimming. To have that taken away, it was really rough at a time where there was an onset of so many hormones and so many things happening in my life while traumatic things were happening, like my poor nervous system. Like, I look back on that time and I'm like, oh my God, you were a child. Like, I felt like an adult because I was like 16 and I was like, I know how to think. I know how to do things. I can drive. But it's like, no, you were a child. You were still like such a baby. Like, you just understand and feel things more, but you don't know how to regulate. And like, I had very dysregulated parents because they have a lot of trauma. And I can be aware of my parents, like, you know, immigration trauma, removal from home trauma, poverty trauma, all these different things. Like, I can be aware, and all the trauma that my mom faced, oh my God, her life, oh, my heart. And I can still be like, I also feel pain from that. I also like had to endure during a lot of it. And once again, it was like, I felt alone. And when I went online and I was talking to random people online, like, there were never any Indian people. There were never any Punjabi people. There were never South Asian or Middle Eastern people or anyone who looked like me ever. And so I never saw myself in anything. So it was like, I have to just notice personality traits and be like, well, I have that personality trait. So at least I can identify or familiarize or empathize in that way or sympathize. And then, I went to college I picked my college based on distance from home, and I picked the furthest away college possible. And my life changed. So then the next chapter, after a lot of confusion and isolation and questioning and, but like affirming I'm straight, I'm a woman, like all these things, like just like, because of how much my body would shake and how like uncomfortable and different I would feel when someone would try and like call me out or quote unquote call me in. And my friends that would tease me that I was bisexual, they were queer themselves. So it wasn't necessarily like a, well, one of them was out queer. One of them didn't come out until much later, but like, so it wasn't necessarily like bullying, you know, it was just kind of like, you're one of us. And I was always like, no, I'm not. So a lot of denial. Also because I was like, I can't take one more thing that makes me feel abnormal, because I'm already feeling so abnormal because I'm dealing with like sexual trauma that I faced, substance abuse trauma within my family, and, you know, physical, verbal, spiritual abuse at the hands of different family members that I faced, that me and my siblings faced, my parents faced, all of us, sometimes with each other, on each other. And then I went to college, and I actually got my first boyfriend, and we were together for 2 years, and he is an amazing guy. Like, looking back on it, I'm just like, I'm so lucky that this guy was my first boyfriend. He's South Asian. I hold such affection for him, right? Like, we were long distance, of course. We were long distance, and we were actually like friends in high school. At my high school, there were like two distinct South Asian, Middle Eastern groups. And basically, you were either part of the South Asians that I was related to, or you weren't. Like, because there weren't that many of us, right? And so he was part of the side that wasn't. And he was always this real, like, quiet, kind of nerdy guy. He's a little taller than me. The sweetest person. He's still, like, in my life tangentially. I'm actually much closer with his brother. But we were together 2 years. And I'm so grateful for the time that I had with him. But, you know, something just didn't feel right. I also needed a lot more attention at the age of 19 than I do now. Like constant attention from a partner than I do now. And we were at a distance, and I wasn't getting enough, from it. And eventually I left because I wasn't happy. We did actually have sex. So he was like the first person in my life that like I had. Oh my God, I skipped such an important thing. Oh my God. Oh my gosh, Sahiba, you're going to learn so much about me, but I'm an open book. So this is what's going to happen. I find myself to this day still very attracted. I can find men very attractive. Like, I can be attracted to them. Now I realize it's a bit more in like a queer way. But back then I just was like, pants feelings, like I'm having pants feelings about this person. That's what I call it, because I don't really know what else to call it. But I actually ended up having sex with this guy that I met online. And he was so nice. We don't talk anymore or anything, but we met up and we hung out for like a few months before I went to college. And I was 18 when we met. Like, I had turned 18 like the week before he and I met. And I had sex with him within the month before I left for college. Because I was just like, because of what had happened to me when I was younger, I was terrified of sex. Like, I was so scared. I was like, this is it. This is dangerous. I'm going to get hurt. Like, all this kind of stuff. So this guy that I like randomly met, I felt pretty safe with him. It was cool. I was like, why not? And so we did. And it was so like, it was such a boring experience for me. Like I went through it, and like, I was in my head the whole time, and I was like, this doesn't feel very nice. I want this to stop. do I want this to stop? Let's just see if I can get into it. Like, these thoughts were just going through my head, like, and whatever, it happened. First person I ever had sex with, and it was this random person that I had met online, which I don't recommend for people, but I feel like is a very common queer experience. And like, I actually wonder what he's up to. He was super talented. Like, he was a musician. He was very talented in that way. Okay, so yeah, so there was that like quickie little like phase, and then and I only bottomed like for this person. So it was very much like cis heterosexual sexual dynamic. And he was so sweet to me. He knew it was my first time. He was very, very sweet with me. He was very, very nice. So I was really grateful. And anytime I needed to pause, he's like, you don't seem like you're into it. Are you okay? Like, so it was a very, like, I was grateful that this person that I had met online and had been talking to for a few months, and then we met in person and then we fooled around. Yeah. But then with my boyfriend, he was like, he wanted to wait till marriage for sex. And I was like, okay, but I'm ready to have sex whenever you're ready. Like, I was like, no pressure, but like, we can have sex whenever. Which I think looking back, I'm like, I had disconnected the sacredness that I now kind of associate with sex, from my being, because I had been, like been through sexual assault as a child. So for me, I was like, it's just a behavior. It's just something we can do. It doesn't matter. But for my boyfriend at the time, he was like, God, he had three priorities in his life: God, family, and friends. Like, and God was first. So he was very much like, I'm gonna wait till marriage. And I was like, okay, wait till marriage. Like, that's fine. We are teenagers, so we're not getting married anytime soon. But eventually, like a year later, he was like, okay, I think I'm ready. And so we did, and it was very sweet. Like, it was very, very sweet sex. It didn't really do much for me. But I tried, and I tried quite a bit. And then after we broke up, I slept with another guy, because I was like, was it just because I was having sex with a virgin that it wasn't pleasurable for me? And no, it wasn't. It wasn't because it was, it just didn't work. It just didn't fit. Like, just we didn't fit. Oh my God, there's so many puns in this interview. But I'm a very sex positive person, and I think awkwardness and discomfort are part of it. Like, it just is. And so, like, I had sex with this other guy, and he was so hot, and I was so attracted to him. And then when we had sex, I was like, is this over? Like, when is this over? Like, kind of thing. Once again, really sweet guy. He was like, all right, cool. If you don't want to, we don't have to. Like, I stopped us in the middle of sex, and then he left. He was like, okay, I'm gonna go. I was like, yeah, just go. Like, whatever. Like, I didn't actually care. But it was chill. He was like fine with it. He wasn't angry or anything. He was just kind of like, okay, well, if we're just gonna be like hanging out, I'm gonna leave. I was like, okay, yes, bye. And then after that, so that was like probably my like straight phase, because I was like an adult, able to engage in sex consensually for the first time in my life. And I was exploring. I was trying to figure things out. And I knew that I like could experience sexual pleasure and sexual arousal, but I wasn't experiencing it with these people, right? And then I went online again, and then I went on Tumblr. And as I was like kind of bouncing around the Tumblrverse, I kind of stumbled upon bisexuality, and then I stumbled upon BDSM, and then I stumbled upon transness. And I actually like, I forget the order of things, but this was like the start of like queerness for me. At least like where I was kind of pursuing it, as opposed to it being kind of like in the periphery. I was like poking the bubble, poking the bear. I was like trying to see what was happening. And I actually met my first partner, my first queer partner, who now, who is trans, actually, online. At the time that we were dating, we weren't considered a straight couple. We were considered a lesbian couple. Whereas now we'd probably be, well, no, now we'd still be, now we'd just be a queer couple. But back then we were considered a lesbian couple. And we were together for 2 years. I met them online on Tumblr. And, you know, I care about them deeply. And I was like, this is going to be the relationship for my life. And pulling on the Indian movie storylines, the first person you meet and first person you have sex with and you feel that connection with, it's going to be together forever. And no, like, it wasn't. We broke up and I broke their heart. And I am sad about that, or I feel for that. And then I entered another queer relationship. There was a gap. There was, I had a online relationship with a BDSM relationship where I was actually, my laptop's gonna die. It was a BDSM relationship where I was a sub and they were a dom, and they were actually a trans woman. And so that was like, at the time, my first like gender expansive queer relationship. And I loved that relationship. That was just like fun. That was just like play. But it wasn't romantic. And then, so yeah, this was like online Adventures of Keen dynamic. This was my early 20s. And then after that ended, I started dating this other person that I had met online on Tumblr. And we were together for 2 years, but that was a horribly abusive relationship. That relationship turned really violent, really fast. The person I was with grew up in a household where all kinds of abuse were just rampant and infidelity was rampant. And so they treated me like I was always going to be cheating on them. And it led to a lot of like jealousy and insecurity and eventually violence. I went to the hospital probably more times in like those 2 years than I have in the rest of my adult life. I had, I had sprained my elbow. I had a concussion. I had the police called on me and my household. I had a domestic violence case number with this person. Yeah, that was, and okay, like looking back on it, they now identify as a man, and I like, I can't help but be like, they're all the same. Men are just awful, but that's just like me coping with it with humor. But that relationship changed me, because going through physical, sexual, spiritual, verbal abuse, I think it changes a person. I think it changes your brain. And this was before I was 25. So my brain was still definitely developing. Just like having the police call on us multiple times and having to talk to the police, like it was such a horrible time. And it was mainly stemming from their jealousy and insecurity, because I had a lot of friends and I wanted to go hang out with them. And they were like, you're not allowed to, essentially. And that went against me so much, because I was like, I'm all alone up here. I worked so hard to create a community up here. And now you're denying me that community. Like, you're, and it's one of the main, like, abuser tactics to like isolate you and like cut you off from your people, which I see now. Like, I feel like so much of that relationship, I was just watching myself like go through these horrible things. And I knew better, like for most of it, I knew better. And I knew the relationship wasn't going to last. But every time we tried to break up, it just kept, they had nowhere to go. And then they were homeless. And then I was like, well, I don't want you to be homeless. And then they were broke. And I was like, well, I don't want you to be hungry. Like, and so I kept taking care of them, but that would feed, that would give them another way to get back into my life. And then I'd block them and then they'd change their number. And then they'd call me from a block number and they knew where I lived. And it was this like tumultuous, oscillating dynamic between two people that we just brought out the worst in each other. And the way that I defended myself in that relationship, I became like someone who screamed. I became someone who broke stuff. I became someone who used my body to stop arguments. And I was like, this isn't me. And it was reminding me so much of like violence that I witnessed in my childhood. I was like, I don't want this for myself. So, I mean, it took 2 years, but eventually it ended and I'm really grateful that it did. And like, I'm still healing from that. Like, I still go to therapy for that relationship because I notice in my current really healthy, beautiful, loving, nurturing relationship that behaviors will come up that definitely stem from the abuse that I experienced back then, a decade ago, you know, and I get really frustrated with myself. And then I have to remind myself like, hey, you're doing your best. Like, and you have a really understanding partner. Like, just share it and then you can work on it together kind of thing. Or just let them know you're working on it and then they'll be patient with you and all you need is patience. So then there was like that chapter of my life was a lot of abuse and violence and I dropped out of school and I was trying to get back into school at that time. But it was really hard to be in school while being in an abusive relationship. Also because when I would try and work on schoolwork, they would throw a fit and they would pick a fight and then I would never get my work done. Because like if I gave my attention to anything else, they felt insecure, essentially. And I tried to end it so many times and I kept letting them back in. And so eventually I started going to therapy again. And I was like, the therapist was like, dude, you need to say what you mean and mean what you say. You need to follow through with when you say this is over, you need to stop talking to them. And I was like, but I can't, you know, and it was a lot of toxicity, but eventually I got out of it. And then I was 25 and all of a sudden I was 25 and fully queer at this point, at least sexuality wise, I was fully queer. And honestly, gender-wise, but I didn't necessarily know gender-wise. I didn't realize that I was performing gender in a way that people label as trans or non-binary or fluid. I didn't realize I was performing gender in that way until my family pointed out how much I was violating what they expected me to perform gender as. So it was like, I was this free person and I was just doing things. And then all of a sudden I was told, wait, that's not how it's supposed to be done. And I feel like that's actually a really common thing with gender is like, you don't realize that you're violating it until someone's like, you're violating it. It's very, very abstract. Which didn't come later until I was 27 and I had gone back home for my sister's wedding and all these clothes that I wanted to wear was not what they would have allowed. And they didn't allow. And so then I was 25 and at 25 was when like I actually really started drinking. I actually drank in high school and then I stopped during college and I just smoked a lot. And then at 25, I started drinking, like actually drinking. I used to hate the taste of alcohol. And then I started appreciating it.
And so that was a bit of a wild time for me. That was the first time I dated someone older than me. My boyfriend was a year older than me, but this is the first time I dated in a queer dynamic where someone was older than me. And that person, great person, lovely soul, super gentle with me, but they had some substance abuse issues, and it kind of pulled me into this whirlwind of like drinking, and they did other drugs. And so I participated with drug use with them, and I was like, I can't be doing this. And I was like fresh out of the abusive relationship. This isn't. And then eventually that person told me they loved me, and I told them, I don't feel the same. And I don't want to placate you, in this dynamic. So I'm going to walk away. And I broke their heart, which I've had my heart broken, and I've broken other people's hearts, and it's rough. It's really, really rough. I will say this. I didn't expect physical abuse from queer relationships. And when I was in one, I was kind of blown away about it. And so, yeah. So then there was 25 to... what was the next phase? So from 25 to 27 was probably the last time that I like identified with the cisgender agenda. And when I went home at 27, this whole time I was still trying to graduate undergrad, but I was dealing with so much stuff with my mental health. And then I also started working, and it was just really hard. And I started to feel really badly about myself, and that affected my performance in school. And school also didn't make it necessarily navigable for me either. I went from being like this really gifted student that like everyone was like, you're going to finish college in 3 years, to dropping out of college and just struggling, just like feeling terribly about myself. Like my mental health hit really, really low. And then the abuse really fed that, like self-deprecating thoughts. And I have fought like hell, and I continue to this day. But yeah, at 27, when I went back home, to my parents' place, and it was my sister's wedding, that was where I really, really, and at that point in my life, I had also befriended enough and immersed myself in the queer community in Northern California. Mind you, it was mainly the white and Latino queer community in Northern California. That I was exposed to more things like drag culture, and I was exposed to more trans people and who were open about it, and then non-binary people. Like, and then I was like, oh, there's like a secret third option, you know, there's like this other option. And then like the way they talked, and I was like, wow, I finally have all these words for all these feelings that I've had for so much of my life. Like, and a lot of my gender expression is through my hair and my clothes. And so I was like, well, I always want to wear certain things, and people say no. And, you know, but I was like, but I love suits, and I love these different, and I want to wear a kurta, and I want to, you know, like I want to be dressed in a certain way. And it just wasn't welcomed. And so, yeah. And then I started really like, you know, connecting with other non-binary people and other trans people. And I felt so seen by them, and they saw me, I mean, and I saw them. And, you know, now I'm 32, and I have been in a relationship for almost 5 years. And, you know, probably in the last like 2 years,
it has been like the first time that I've really connected with other South Asian queer people. And it's interestingly, it's also been where the most that I've learned about caste dynamics as well. My parents brought me up very much like in the way that like caste doesn't exist out here in the States kind of thing. And then, you know, I learned, well, what's our caste? Because they never said that. I that was not something I was exposed to at all growing up, which is 100% privilege. And it's 100% attached to my ignorance of my own privilege. Because with privilege comes the ignorance of it. But, you know, I had the light bulb awakened when I was around the age of 30. And then I started like, now I see it, you know, now I'm like very, very much more aware of it. I'm trying to learn about it. I'm trying to actively, you know, participate in anti-caste, live an anti-caste lifestyle, try to, you know, more abolitionist. Like my queerness is definitely political and it informs me to trying to and exposes me to the existence of others and the perspectives of others. And I always want to hear from other people about what they're going through and what's happening. And so it can better inform me about, you know, how to conduct myself and to create safe spaces for everybody. So everyone feels brave enough to be themselves. If they're not hurting people, you know, or infringing upon other people's consent, I want them to be, you know, brave enough to be themselves and feel safe. And, you know, now I'm really learning about how insidious caste is and how it is all over the world and how, you know, last names designate caste and all these different things that you know, I try to embody within myself and in my practices. And in the way that I love, like just trying to let it be a place of growth, you know, and hold space for all the pain that we've all been through and like try to be gentle. I just want to be gentle and soft and but hold firm to my beliefs and my values and carry that forward. And so the current chapter that I'm in is probably the most free that I've ever been with my gender and sexuality because I can perform it any way that feels true to myself. And I have a partner who respects that. And I have friends who honor it. And I have, you know, I still have the issues of my gender, you know, with my family and stuff. They're still trying to catch up on it. But, you know, it took my parents 7 years to get to a point where they were comfortable enough to invite a partner of mine into the home. So let's see. Like I have hope as I go forward with it, with my family and also to be in community with other South Asian queers. And I hope that this interview, this recording can be like almost like a calling card as a way. So hopefully we can see each other. And I think it's the way that queerness has informed me in this way is that like I am aware of marginalization and hierarchies of power and how that plays out in social dynamics, interpersonal dynamics. And I hope that I feel like what I have seen with queer Punjabi Sikh people, at least the ones who are aware of their caste privilege and are aware that it is a privilege, that it's so much love. It's so much space. It's so much awareness of our connection to each other, our connection to the world, our willingness to help
and be open and to see each other. Like, it's so beautiful. I'm so grateful for those relationships in my life. And I want more of them. And I want to cultivate that in my life. I want to keep feeding that side of me as well, because it feels more like home, and it feels like belonging in a way that hasn't really existed for me in my life ever up until this point. And this is probably the most I've felt it, for which I'm very, very grateful.
Oh, no, thank you so much for just gifting like all of those like stories and for all of those like experiences to me. Like, there's just, I'm just filled with so much like appreciation and gratitude to just be a witness to your journey. So thank you for allowing me to be a witness and for being just so generous with your time and with your experience as well. And there's, I have like I have a lot of other questions, but I also do want to be mindful of your time and energy as well. Yeah. So wanted to like do a check-in to see how you're doing, because I know I had said like the interview would take like up to 2 hours, but we are like over 2 hours now.
Yeah.
So I want to be just mindful of like how you're doing, and if you would want, I'm happy to like, in terms of like, I would love to even organize in terms of another time to like continue with the other questions, or if you feel up for it, I can ask the next question too. But just wanted to do a check-in to see how you are doing, because I know this also must be a lot in the context of like kind of reflecting and sharing and like pouring yourself out in this way, like not just to me, but like also I guess like to other listeners as well. So like I'm sure this is a lot. So wanted to kind of see how you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to talk so long and so much. I didn't know how many questions you had. So I was like, oh, if it's just a couple questions, I'll just share it all. Yeah. But you probably have it categorized or like organized in a much different way. I am totally okay to keep going for like a little bit longer, but I also want to be mindful of your time. I don't know how much time you have to hold, because I know you said it for 2 hours. We can absolutely move it to another day if that fits your schedule better. So where are you at? Yeah. Like, I could still talk for a little bit longer.
Yeah. I'm also good to continue as well. I just wanted to make sure you were also okay.
Okay. Thank you for checking in. I appreciate.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you. And I guess like kind of transitioning a little bit, but also in relationship to that question about the phases, when thinking about your relationship to Sikhi, like how would you say you learned more about Sikhs and Sikhi, and how I know you've already started to kind of touch on some of those experiences, but wanted to kind of see like if thinking about your relationship to Sikhi and how it's changed and evolved over the course of your life, if you had to define some of your life in terms of phases in the context of your relationship to Sikhi, like what would those phases look like and what would they be?
I would probably say like me at my most devout was my first 12 years of life. Like that was when I was going to Gurdwara every Sunday. That was when my parents tried to sign me up for like Punjabi classes. That was, the only time that I ever got out of, or not got out, but the only time I didn't go to the Gurdwara was when I had a soccer tournament. That like went through on a Sunday. But yeah, the most like, and by devout, I mean like when I was consistently attending like the Gurdwara. So it was probably those like first years. I think after going to India when I was 12 and, you know, traumatic things happened, I like, so disconnected from myself that included Sikhism. I've always identified myself as Sikh or Punjabi, like Punjabi, Sikh Punjabi is how I've always identified. And you know, as I got older, going through high school, like because I was just kind of drowning, I would go to the Gurdwara intermittently. Sometimes I would attend weddings. Learning about Sikhism came a lot from like when I would visit India and my like Masis would talk to me about like different aspects of the religion, not necessarily like quotes from the Guru Granth Sahib, but like just incorporating the morals, almost like fabulistic. Like I loved fables. I loved folk tales. I loved learning about those. And one of my Masi's husbands, he had all of the folk tales. So I loved just sitting and listening to him. And he had so many like, that he taught me. And then, so it kind of like phased out a bit more in high school, but also in high school, like if you're different in the slightest way, people attack. So it was like, I was different because I was, you know, South Asian, and I actually went to a decently diverse school. It was predominantly Asian, but it was mainly East Asian kids, as opposed to like South Asian or Southeast Asian kids. So I was unique still. I remember taking a standardized test. And anytime I take a standardized anything, to this day, they don't have Punjabi or Sikh on any of them. And so, yeah, I remember my teacher being like, what is that? Is that like Pakistani? And I was just like, sure. Like, you know, like I didn't know what to say because I was 9 years old. And it's interesting because, you know, borders are all made up. I do actually have... My family hailed from from Pakistan, but they were, you know, they had to migrate south to Mumbai and Delhi because of partition. But so I'm like, yeah, kind of, but not in the way that you think. Like, you know, like how do you put that? You can't put that on a standardized test. But I never felt like bad about my difference. I remember. And then, you know, as in high school, because it was all more about assimilation to be like accepted, I remember feeling so anxious about being seen in any desi kapra that I was wearing. Like any salwar kameez, especially salwar kameez, cotton salwar kameez was like such a like comfortable traditional thing that I would wear to the gurdwara. And then we'd go get food afterwards, you know, and I remember being like almost embarrassed to be seen in that outfit. And now I'm like, absolutely not. Now I will walk in it in my full power in any space. Like I am grateful to be able to be wearing what I want to wear in the presence of whomever. But as a kid, it's like the, oh my God, don't look at me. Like I'm gonna die from embarrassment type things phase. And then, you know, I went to, so I kind of like lost, like I was still involved, but I wanted to be cool, you know, and it wasn't cool to be different around like high school age. And then, you know, when I went to college, I pretty much like disconnected from Sikhism. I didn't really understand the language. I had faced so much suppression because of, you know, being socialized as a woman and like not feeling special, and feeling like being Indian, being Punjabi meant being in service of men. And, you know, these were the stories I was living my life as, like, following. So I was like, why would I continue that? You know, why would I perpetuate that? Because misogyny made me very angry. And I witnessed that so much at every single party that I went to, South Asian party, because of how the women were treated as opposed to the men and how I was treated as opposed to my brother and my cousins and stuff like that. And how all the men just get to sit and talk and chat and whatever the fuck they talk about. And then all the women are just running around like crazy, making all the food, serving, cleaning, constantly. It wasn't for me. It felt very, very against what felt good to me. The only times that I was ever really like in it was when I would visit home, you know, or I would listen to the music or I'd eat the food. I'd feel those connections again. And I wore my cara. I still actually kept my cara. I've always had my cara. I keep it with me at all times. It's changed through the years and stuff, but that is one that I tend to keep on even to this day. Actually, you know what's so funny? When it's really hot out, I have eczema, bracelets like tend to, or anything on my wrists or skin tend to like cause eczema reactions. So that's probably like the only time that I don't wear my cara as often. Because like the sweat and just like the aggravation of it on my skin. Yeah, you know, and then it became like a thing where I only really listened to, in my 20s, I only really listened to like bhajans or prayers or even going to the Gurdwara happened when I was with my family and they were going or they were playing it at home. Like they had recordings of it. They were playing it at home. Now my dad, like, because he can't make it to the Gurdwara every Sunday, he actually is part of this. Ever since the pandemic, they've started doing it online. So he just tunes in and listens to it, like, on his phone at home. So now, like, listening to prayers when I visit home tends to be how I'm like, attached to it. I guess, like, or actively attached to it. But, you know, like, after having my caste privilege bubble popped in my late 20s, I've become much more interested in learning about it and being more of an active participant in what Sikhism is and, like, learning how Sikhi, the origin of it was actually like an abolitionist initiative. It was something to be like, we are all human. Why would we heed something like caste? We need to extend our love to everyone. Learning that was what it was and drop the last name. And that's where Kaur came from. That's where Singh came from. I was like, I don't know. It felt like a calling almost to me. And I was like, that's amazing. I didn't know that that was what Sikhism was. I didn't know that was what Sikhi preaches and all that kind of stuff. So I've become more interested in learning about it. And then I learned about the way that people practicing Sikhi have brought Brahminical casteist hierarchy to Sikhism, and I'm like, fucking hell, dude, like can't the people who want us to just be like equitable and humans with each other, why can't we win? Like it's very interesting being a part of something that's not a populist movement and being on the side that is still, you know, for abolish the caste system mentality and goals, and just like I'm learning so much. And I'm like, this is what my ancestors tried for. This is what they wanted. This is what carries out through my history. And, you know, with British imperialism and Brahminical casteism, so much has been wiped from my history. I don't know anyone in my family past my dada dadi. Like, and that is by design. And so now I find myself, I've always been very thirsty for knowledge. I've always loved reading. I've always loved learning. And so now I find myself actually participating in it more, but from the angle, I guess, of like political participation and trying to participate in it and carrying forth this abolitionist mentality now. So so this phase of my life in Sikhi is probably closer to the guru's lessons and morals than when I was a kid, just kind of following along with my parents. I feel more active in it now. And, you know, I do know that in Sikhi, they, my dad says this quote to me all the time because my dad loves quotes. But he said, like, Sikhism is like, like women in Sikhi are strong, for they give birth to kings, or something like that. And I'm like, he's got the spirit. The message is a bit off to me. You know, it's like, you know, women have more to offer than just producing men. But, you know, at least, you know, I can't really think of another religion that kind of holds women like to a certain feminine, like I feel like Sikhi is more feminist than other religions. And so I'm like grateful for that, because my dad is a self-proclaimed feminist. He does believe in the power of women. He does believe that women are powerful. He's never been one to purport that kind of idea that like women do this and men do this. Like he never pushed that on me, which I feel like is very unique. I have very unique experience with that. It was more my brother that was like, men are superior and men can do this and women can't do shit. And like all this like horrible misogynistic bullshit. But my dad was like, no, in Sikhism, in Sikhi, like women are great. Like women are powerful. Women have power. Like we can't do anything without them, kind of stuff. And so like understanding that more now, I'm like, it kind of makes sense that my values are what my values are, and I recognize it more. And I always introduce myself with Sikhi as part of my identity. I always have. I think I was reconciling more with my queerness for a lot of my 20s, that now I'm like trying to look at myself as like a whole person. And Sikhi absolutely informs how I carry myself in this world, and my connection to it. But I have lost my way as well, like as it goes. And I don't necessarily know how to, embody that spirituality in community with others, because I still feel on the outside a bit due to my queerness. And I just, you know, this is something unique to someone like me. But I believe it's possible. I believe that like my queerness has, you know, and my Sikhi identity, like I believe that we can get to an abolished caste future. I believe in in that kind of future for us, where we're all welcome and we're treated by like the content of like who we are, not just by our caste or our sexuality, or genders, because all of this exists pre-coloniality, and here we are in the trenches just trying to hold on to each other, you know.
Thank you so much for sharing that too, and for there's like so many questions that are like coming out from that I want to touch on, such as whether it's like questions about like coming out and like kind of what that means, like what your experience has been with that, or even in thinking further about like your relationship to Sikhi and the Sikh community, like how that's been, what does it even mean to be a Sikh, and have those types of questions. So as well as like even thinking about what it means to be part of like the LGBTQIA plus community, because even that, as you were like kind of naming, is something that you've grappled with for quite like an extended period of time. So that has also been like in itself a journey that also like of course is ongoing. So with all this said, like how do you feel about like scheduling based on your capacity and based on your time, like a second round of like interview too, for like kind of these second set of questions? That's why I'm like, or in just to kind of also be like respectful of your energy as well. And then Also, like, from my end, like, being on the East Coast, like, I haven't eaten yet, too, so I'll go eat, like, lunch after this, too.
Oh, my God. How about you have to go eat? Yes.
Yeah, so, and then, but that way, like, in terms of, like, the conversation itself, though, like, I would love to continue it, because there's just, I feel like, from your end, like, there's just so much, like, there's so many, like, rich stories that, like, need to be told, and I'm really, really thankful that, like, you're also, like, taking the time out to share them with me, and to get them archived, so I really want to, like, kind of make sure that the space, like, continues to, like, maintain its richness and continues to, also, all while, like, respecting and honoring, like, preserving your capacity and preserving your energy, too.
Yeah, no, and I really, really appreciate that. Do you think you'll just, I also, like, I have,
yeah.
It might be a trauma response. I don't know. Yeah. I have issues with, like, taking up space. So I feel like I'm just, like, taking up, like, so much of your time. And, like, I've been talking so much about, like, just, like, the first three questions. And I really want to be mindful of your time. And
No. I 100% like hear you. And what's it called? I think it also may be more so because it's like, given that it's an oral history interview where like my role is to not talk. Like maybe hence it may feel like it's like imbalanced because it's like, oh, I'm just my role. Like I don't even provide like, oh, this makes me think about what I just, there's like very little validation, even very little like response I'm giving. And I just move on to the question. And I really do apologize for like how that is, because I know it really does it's or this just oral, that's kind of one of the I guess limitations of like an oral history, because oral history is just focused, it's supposed to be about you and like less of like a conversation and more of like an attempt to archive your life story and yours, so I totally can see where in terms of like where that could come from, but please please do not like, please don't think that at all, like please don't worry, especially because one, like this is the very purpose of this in terms of like you have so much to offer and like the stories that you have, the journey that you like have been on, like it is like as you've also kind of named, right, like when you were saying like it's hard to like find validation for who you are and find like even a reason for you to like be able to articulate your existence when you don't see your existence reflected anywhere, so kind of like, so all of that to say like your story, like you telling it like is so important because like other folks like will be able to like see and will find resonance and where other folks will find like something that they can hold on to validate their own existence. Like as I even reflect on my own journey, like it was through like, for example, seeing Brub and like seeing like Brub's like, and kind of coming across like when I was looking up queer and sick and I was like, oh my God, like it's possible to be like queer, trans and sick. Right. So all that to say, like, please don't feel as if like you're taking up like too much time or like taking, you're talking too much or like any of those things, because like this is what this is for, and this is it's like an honor for me to be holding this, and it's an honor for me to be like just a facilitator and a witness and a listener to your story, so I hope that like you don't walk away feeling as if like you took up too much space or like, because I appreciate that like for each of these questions you've been giving such a thorough and such a rich response that like so much like it I'm already taking away, and I'm excited for other folks, like when they do also witness, like how much they'll also like be in conversation with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I appreciate you saying that. Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
I was like, I know I have a tendency I can ramble. So I also want to be like mindful. I was like, you probably have deadlines and you have things to do.
Oh my God. No, not at all. Not at all. Like this is what today was in terms of like, I was like, oh, this will be our like first interview. We'll see. We'll just kind of go with the flow to see like, you know, how much we get through, how many questions we get through. And absolutely. We can schedule like another round to keep the conversation going. Give like a, just cause we've gotten through about like, one section out of like three sections, so that's why I just wanted to kind of be mindful of also like how much, because I can sometimes, or it can start to feel extractive too, because I'm, since my role is just asking questions and you're like offering so much, so that's why for that purpose too I'm like, oh, let's maybe like it maybe, or this seems like a good place to like pause before transitioning into like the next part, so it feels like a smooth transition, or like a place to like pause and then come pick back up.
Sure. With, yeah, absolutely. What do you want to, will you just send like another calendar invite?
Yeah, is that okay? Like, I can also, I can send you my, or I can just drop it into the chat actually as well. Or, let me see. I'll also stop the recording.